you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime, all the places, and my second feature script is written.
Yay! I'm Liz Manishaw. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. I'm currently in the fundraising period of my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a distribution consultant and a producer's rep, and I used to work at Sundance.
This week, we welcome writer-director Liz W. Garcia on the show to talk about directing her latest feature, Space Cadet, and how she made the jump from directing $1 million movies or so to a mid-tier studio feature. After that, we play another round of The Game. But first, Liz, how are you doing today?
I'm okay. We're about to fly to across the country in a few days. And this was the reason why I did not want to have a second child, was this exact scenario that I'm about to be in 2 days. I like waited 4 years to have a second child because I was like, I do not want to be on an airplane with two children. And now I'm facing my greatest fear. So I'm just trying to create like backup plan upon backup plan for like what all of the impossible scenarios, like I'm getting Band-Aids, I'm getting backup snacks, I'm getting backup outfits, I'm, you know, like screens, lots of screens, distractions, like what can I bring? What do I have? I'm going to have like the emergency fruit snack in the bottom of the bag. You know what I mean? Just in case you need an emergency fruit snack. So that's what's going on with me, is just personal travel anxiety. How are you?
Well, I want to ask more questions about other stuff, but I have to chime in on this. So yeah. Wait, first off, didn't you do this before, or is this the first time you're flying with two children?
Oh, I think I did do this before. I did do this before. I did this. This is how bad it was. I blocked it out. Well, I did this. Yes, we did this in December. So it'll be 6 months later, which means our child is 6 months more of a problem in traveling.
That's one way of looking at it. I did it once before, too, with two children. And yeah, it was definitely a deal.
Yeah.
But the trick I do is like new snacks, different snacks.
Oh,
each snack is more different and new than the last snack. Like, we'll just get things that she never had before. Like, we'll just go to a different store or just pick different things. And like each one is a surprise. And it's like, you know, if she gets upset, it's like, oh, well, look, now we have this brand new snack for you. Oh, and then the stewardess brought you a snack that's new. It's like, you have new snacks. Oh, you didn't even know you had this new snack. Like, here's another new snack. It's just snacks coming out of the bag, like surprise snacks. But yeah, screens. Yes, we have a tablet that we use, which is great. She has her own little headphones that she wears.
Yeah, us too.
So it's like, it's a whole orchestrated deal. Yeah, but yeah, you're right. Like now that the kids are, whatever, 6 months older, it's like, it's going to be a lot harder to hold them in the seat without them wiggling away. Mm-hmm. I remember that moment with Bibi when like the first time we flew with her, she just slept and was so easy.
Oh, yeah.
It was nice.
So cute.
And then the second time she's like spreading her body out across both of us and like, ah, and then it was like, we need to put you in a seat for the next one. But I think we're going to, we're flying on Tuesday and it's going to be a deal. It's early in the morning though. It's really ungodly early. It's like 5:30 in the morning. So there's a good chance that they're like going to just fall right to sleep, you know?
That's great. That's wonderful.
So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, isn't your crowdfunding campaign like starting in a week, 2 weeks? What's going on?
We're probably going to launch July 15th. We were going to launch July 7th. I'm just not trying to kill myself when I have latitude. Like if there's latitude, if I'm choosing the date, why am I trying to kill myself? You know what I mean?
Why July 7th right after July 4th? It's like, you're just like, can I murder myself here, please?
Because I get back the 6th. So let me give myself one day to survive. Yeah. it's coming up. It's coming up. I was looking at the text today. I have to submit it to Kickstarter for their approval still. I'm finalizing incentives/rewards. Like I'm refamiliarizing myself with the whole thing. The Kickstarter video is almost done. Like we're there. It's just, I want to be all hands on deck and I want to be like fully fueled up in terms of energy and availability for when we launch. And I don't want to rush it. So we're doing it. it's happening. It just needs to happen when we're present, I guess.
Nice.
Yeah. How are you?
And yeah, I'm good. You know, I've been working on Amy Taylor's movie. I still haven't gotten to the editing part yet, which is terrible. And I feel so bad. I mean, it does take a long time to organize all the footage. And I am like 2/3 through. So I've made like big progress on this thing. So I'm getting close. I think maybe this week or next week, I'll be able to start actually editing. But I am going to be out of town all of next week. So yeah, Amy, I'm sorry. It's just taking a long time. This is my apology to you through the internet. I am sorry it's taking so long to get on your movie. But yeah, it is fun to like work on that. And like, I'm really excited to get editing because it's going to be fun to, you know, be a part of something creative, you know?
Yeah.
And get to work on someone else's beautiful vision that they've sculpted, you know? And yeah, I don't know. I've been thinking a lot lately about filmmaking and like, I really want to make something soon. And I think if I'm going to make anything, it's going to be part of this feature that I wrote. Like that just, that's the only thing that makes sense. But yeah, I don't have any money and like, I don't have it in me right now to like really start fundraising. I think I need to wait a little while, you know? So like, I'm sort of just like in the gestation period, you know? It's just like, it's all like, I'm like, you know, the movie's in like a little bowl of water, you know, like in a little embryo. It's just, you know, gestating and growing and figuring itself out.
The bowl of water that is the placenta. Like the bowl, I love the way you put that.
Like a sphere of water, you know, like that, you know, since I'm not a woman, it's not in my body.
Yeah, it could be whatever you want. Out, it could be like a beer stein. Yeah.
It's like in a 3D space somewhere. Yeah. You know, just like doing its thing. So, yeah, I'm just letting it do its thing in my brain, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And just like giving it time and not rushing into it. And like I think about opening up the script. And I don't, you know, although I did work on it like 2 weeks ago because like there was somebody who asked to read it. And so I was like, all right, like, let me actually just do a little tidying and a little fixing and stuff. And that was nice. But like the big things I want to do with a movie like involve like really heavily going through like each scene and adjusting dialogue for like pretty much each scene for each character. And so like that is just like a really time intensive thing that like I have to do at some point. But like I'm just not ready to do that yet. What I really want to start doing, I think, which would be more fun for me and also help with the rewriting process, is to think about like what would I shoot first and why, and like what would it look like as a concept piece if I did that? Like what pieces should I aim to shoot, and like how would I logistically manage that in a way that makes sense?
That's a fun thing to do, think about. Okay, that does not sound fun at all to me. That sounds like there's so many permutations that could happen. That sounds like a big question.
Well, I remember when I was trying to think of like how I would present the alternate to people like in a concept movie or whatever. Like I basically came up with another like an alternate version, if you will, of a couple of the scenes or one scene that was like, you know, that would live on its own and be like its own little teaser thing. And so I kind of rewrote like a little small section of the movie into this teaser.
Yeah.
I don't think I would really do that for this, probably. I think it would be more like just finding the right moments or the right scene to present. But then I don't know. But as I think about it, maybe it would be that. Maybe it would be like a changed version of the movie, like where it would be the same pieces, which is different than last time. Last time I shot this. I basically ended up shooting the same scene differently for the feature. But in this version, it would be the same footage that would go in the feature, just re-edited into the short version. So yeah, that's like the next thing. And it is kind of fun to like think about like there's some fun for me in the logistical part of it. And in like the creative part of like, what do you want your, you know, the people who are going to help you make the movie, like what do you want them to see first? Like, what do you think is going to get them the most excited about it? You know, like, I think there is some fun in that process. And the last thought I had, which I want to share, is I've been thinking about, like, you know, we talked to Liz, was a good example, who's the guest on our show today. I feel like the filmmakers who are successful that we've talked to on the show, they don't tend to have backup plans. And they don't tend to, like, be doing it on the side and, like, you know, like it's not their main thing and they have like a day job. Like some people for sure, like there's definitely been a lot of success stories where that's the case. But I think for the most part, a lot of people who end up being successful are like people who just like say, fuck it, I'm committing to it. And I'm like throwing caution to the wind. And this is my life now, you know? And I think like that, I wonder if I need to do that to be a more successful filmmaker. If I just need to like, you know, somehow set myself up in a situation where that just becomes my main thing and I don't do a day job. But it's not feasible in my life now to do that. But maybe in 10, 15 years it would be, you know? So I've just been thinking about that.
Well, there's shades of gray there. Like I think there's a lot that they're not telling us when we interview people, right? Like there's a lot of financials that we don't have access to that, yeah, maybe we could get like an answer, like a tip of the iceberg answer, but no one's going to be like, yeah, my ex bankrolls me or I have family money or I receive passive income from this or that, because there's still such luster to that, like, yeah, I'm a filmmaker and that's my due and I have value just being a filmmaker. Like the myth still has value. I also think, and that doesn't apply to, I'm not saying that about Liz Garcia. I'm just saying of other interviews we've had, I don't think they've always been very honest. I think the other thing is like, we'll talk, you know, people will listen to the show, but like Liz is a writer. So she probably thinks of her income stream as a writer as also artists' revenue, right? But you and I think we kind of put that director role up on a pedestal a little bit. And it's like, that's where we want to make the money. Is that right? Like, that's where we want the bulk of our salaries to come from.
If I could get paid to write movies, I would definitely be doing that for sure. Okay. But, you know,
she didn't say fuck it, I'm taking a chance. It's like she had it was freelance, but she had a certain level of demand and stability in the TV writing world. So I would say she might not be the 100% best example of the like jump in without a net argument.
Yeah, no, not necessarily. But I'm just saying that like, you know, like if I want to be making movies or TV or whatever, it's like I need to make movies and TV, you know. Yeah. Like I shouldn't be making corporate video as the 90% of the thing that I do. But like I don't have the opportunity right now to make that change, you know. But if I did, if I somehow had someone who was like, hey, I'll pay you, you know, $25,000 to write a feature script, and I've got three more where that came from, then it would be like, okay, sure, I could do that for my career. But everybody I've talked to, it's not like that. Like it's always tricky and hard and difficult. And yeah, it's really dicey to like, you know, like you can't rely on it. And like the people who do need to rely on it, they're constantly hustling. So I don't know. I think I'm more comfortable in the situation I am. I just wonder if like, am I going to get to where I want to go this way, you know, and maybe not, you know, or maybe this is fine. And like, I just get to make movies when I get to make movies. And that's a great way to live life too. Like, I don't know. I think maybe that's probably more, you know, where I get to land with this. But another place, great place where anyone can land with their fingers on their keyboards and in their computers and phones is our Patreon page. Go to www.patreon.com/MMIHpodcast to check out what we got going on there. This is the way the show continues to thrive and live and grow and be. So thanks to everyone who has supported us on Patreon, all our patrons out there. You guys rock. Also, make sure to leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. That is another great way to spread the show and get more people to check us out and hear the words that we're saying. But without any more delay, here's our chat with Liz W. Garcia.
Well, we'll jump right in then. We'd like to start off with the elevator pitch for the film that we're talking about. Do you mind giving the elevator pitch for Space Cadet?
Not at all. Maybe even shorter than an elevator pitch is the unofficial, very unofficial logline, which was Legally Blonde at astronaut training camp. So unofficial for obvious reasons. But elevator pitch is a woman who is a Florida bartender and party girl rediscovers her wish, her childhood dream of becoming an astronaut. And after her 10th high school reunion, decides that she's going to pivot back to this dream. She is totally unqualified. However, her best friend, instead of proofreading her resume, augments it, let's say, and makes it appear as though she is qualified. And then she gets into astronaut training camp and has to go and see if she can hold her own with the people who do have all the right credentials.
And then how many days did you shoot the film?
It's funny how this becomes a blur, like the way you forget pain, you know, because it's never enough. It's like, I think we had maybe 27. Most of it was in New Jersey. And then we had a week at the Air and Space Museum in Huntsville, Alabama.
Where my husband is from. Been there many, many times. We're not expecting, you know, a specific answer here, but what can you speak of with regard to the budget of the film?
I can say that it's mid-budget. It's rare to do a mid-budget movie these days. Yeah. And it was so much more than any budget that I've ever made a movie with. So that was really exciting. You still wind up feeling like you're having to make major compromises and you're worried that they're the wrong compromises. But I did feel the difference. Like, I really felt the difference between $1 million movie and a not $1 million movie. And I felt it in the experience level of the crew. And, you know, you just don't have to be as scrappy. And sometimes scrappy is great for creativity. And other times it's the absolute opposite. Sometimes being scrappy is just, you're making compromises that really do show up on the screen. And it's sad and disappointing. And I didn't feel like I had to make nearly as many of those this time around.
And then can you talk about how you came up with the idea? Like, what was the origin of this story?
Sure. So, I mean, I think important piece of background information is that I made my second film for $1.1 million. I, you know, was like toting my kids around from rental house to rental house, paying the nanny on a credit card. Like, it was so hard and it was so bleak having to make that tiny movie. And I loved the movie, but when it was done, I really felt like, you know what? It's time for me to have what the boys have. Like, the men are making movies with real money and real resources. And I want that for myself. And it's going to be my third film, whatever I do next. And I deserve it. So I was in that mentality, like, it's time to make a larger movie. And also, in terms of my relationship to my craft, I had become at that point more interested in trying to write genre, meaning not just writing what sort of spilled from my soul, but like working within a more strict paradigm to just get closer to master screenwriting, really. That was the first thing I wanted to sort of get better at. Also, just because I love the medium and it was like, okay, I've reached a certain level of being able to do this and I want to get to the next level. And so I had my eyes open for what that idea would be for this theoretical third movie. And I saw a news item that NASA had its first class of astronaut candidates where it was 50% female, 50% male. Just thought it was an interesting news item. I read it because I was curious about who the women were. And then I started to read about these women and these men and read about what was required to get to the point that you, that NASA would even consider considering you. And it was so outrageous. It was so extreme that you had to be accomplished in your field professionally, in a math or science field. You had to also be physically fit, sane. Ideally, you had at least 1,000 hours of flying a jet. So a lot of these people had not just military experience, but like excellent military experience. And it almost felt like, how are there enough of these people that NASA has a hard time whittling it down? And, you know, those type of extreme characters are great for comedy. And I just started to think like these roles of very, very competitive, accomplished women would be so fun to cast in a movie where you're watching a comedy, especially like female excellence in this way and women competing with each other, not over men. Like, I don't really see that in my life. What I see more is what I grew up with, which was like really hardcore, accomplished girls and women academically, athletically. And I felt like not only had I not seen that and not seen a space movie for women or girls, but that I wanted to do it. It would amuse me and delight me to be the one who did it and spent time in that world. So those were the circumstances that created the seed.
When did you see that article? We're just putting together a timeline of like inspiration striking and how long it takes to get the film off the ground.
So I think I saw the article 2014, and then it was sort of floating around. And then after that, subsequently, NASA's almost every class of astronaut candidates has been, they don't have a class every year, but almost every class of astronaut candidates has been 50-50 male, female. So I was seeing that pop up again. And this came about as a lot of my scripts come about, like they take a few years to gestate before I put the proverbial pen to paper. So I was thinking about it for a long while before I started to work on the concept in 2017, 2018, pitched it to, I was going to write it on spec, but then I had a general meeting at Stampede. I pitched it to Greg Silverman, who's the head of that company. I think I got through like half the log line or half the elevator pitch. And he's like he knew what it was immediately and was so excited. And just said, don't write it on spec. I want to make the movie. Like, we'll pay you. Let's do this. Which was, I mean,
wow.
And then I think it took, so let's say that was like maybe early 2019. And then we made this movie summer, fall 2022. So that's not long. That was about 3 years. And the whole time Stampede was like, I'm so sorry it's taking so long. Like, the second movie took 16 years. I'm like, I'm fine. I'll be here. I know it's going to work out. Like,
yeah. Awesome.
And now this is kind of like an open-ended question. Like, if you could change one thing about the film in any way, it could be the film itself. It could be the process of making the film. It could be something that you took to get the movie made. Like, what would that one thing be?
I'm going to be slightly vague so as not to hurt anyone's feelings. But, you know, and I'll sort of put it back on me. I'll say that there were elements of the process that where I maybe talked myself out of some of my feelings. So generally, what's wonderful about directing is that you share the pressure with your assistant director and your producers. Like, they're all of these people, you're all working on the same problem. But at a certain point, it comes down to you. And I'm a very diplomatic person. And I'm also I'm interested in the puzzle of the compromises that you have to make. I actually like that part of it. Like, you don't get to have X. So how are you going to, you know, how can you use Y instead? But there were times where I think I felt rushed and I knew that to speak up and say, this isn't good enough would cost money and derail the timeline. And I don't know if all directors feel that way. I know that I've talked to other female directors who struggle with that. Like, you don't want to be an asshole, but we've been taught our whole lives to not be assholes. So sometimes you actually are too nice. You're too diplomatic. And I won't be as diplomatic next time.
Mm. You're so cool. You're just very cool. We're friends with Milan Chakraborty, who I know was on your team for The Lifeguard. He's been on the show, by the way, and talked a little bit about it. I know he's very, very proud of that film and he brings it up all the time. I'm curious because 1.1 million, I totally agree. Like, it's never enough money and it is considered low budget, but it's still a meaningful amount of resource compared to, you know, some emerging filmmakers that have to deal with micro budgets, right? I love the faith that you have, the very earned faith you have in yourself about how you deserve the opportunity. I'm just curious because you've also had the system reinforce that, like, which is like deservedly so. Do you think you'd still have that faith in yourself had you not gotten into Sundance, had you not gotten on the shows that you've been a part of? Like, did you earn that confidence through the system or through internal means?
I mean, I love this question because I think that the truth of it is really important, which is that I've had the experience of, like, I joke to myself that I have the career of a man half my age. You know, yes, The Lifeguard got into Sundance. The Lifeguard was also absolutely skewered by male critics, and male critics are most of the critics. When male critics skewer your movie, you don't get the distribution and release that you should, you know. So I've had my career in television has been really has been supported by the system, very much so. it's a less, television is less sexist. My experience as a female director has been like, there's been no support from the system. I made The Lifeguard with Milan and my ex-husband and myself, you know, and some of our other producers who are our friends. And that's, you know, I got the same amount of money, actually slightly less, to make my next film 1% More Humid. You know, the people at Sony who distributed it were totally lovely, but that's a tiny movie. And, you know, I don't get incoming business for my directing career. It exists because I've created these projects, and then I've been lucky enough to have like an ally here or there, like Greg Silverman at Stampede, who I've known for a long time. It's like, oh, I see your vision and I trust you. But I don't, you know, the thing about going to Sundance is it almost creates like a high school class, right? Like there are just, let's say, a dozen of you who've all gotten your films into the domestic competition. And so then, and you're, which means you're all at the same point. And from there, you can watch from that ostensibly level playing field, you can watch how people's careers change. Now, there were people who brought their first film to Sundance and went on to make $100 million movies with Fox. And those people were men. So, you know, I think for me to get to the point where I'm like, I deserve a larger budget and I deserve resources and people who are supporting me in this career because I'm going to make them money. Like that's, I don't know, that's a result of turning 40 and being confident, not because anyone around me was like, hey, come on, we want to convince you to be more successful. I was more like, fuck this.
So talk about that, because like it's one thing to have that feeling and to have that emotion and like take that power and courage and bravery, you know, whatever it is, to go make that decision. But actually getting it done is like a completely different thing. So like talk about like how you actually went from like a 1.1 million budget to like, you know, a mid-tier movie on your third feature.
Well, so like I said, okay, so my plan was I'm going to write this on spec with me attached to direct it. And, you know, we'll see how long that gets to be set up and get going. But it's not just part of growing my directing career. It's also, I have no choice. This is how I make a living. So I have to constantly be generating work and looking for jobs. And, you know, it's not all about confidence. It's about need. So I started working on this idea. At that time, I lived in New York. I still do, but I just moved to New York. I went back to LA to take a bunch of general meetings. I was like, I need a job. Like, hopefully one of these meetings is going to create a job for me. But I was surprised to sell. I was not intending to go pitching Space Cadet. I was going to write it on spec. So I was surprised that Greg bought it. And then what happens is, you know, the movie, the budget is linked to the content of the film. So this is not a movie that could have been made for $1 million. It's just not. If anybody wanted to make it, they had to make it for much more than that. And Stampede believed in it. And it's a commercial premise. I mean, The Lifeguard and 1% More Humid are not, they're indie movies. They're meant to be small. And, you know, part of that is because that's what I was interested in. Part of that is like, well, when you're a first time or a second time female filmmaker, that's the size of movie that you can get made. So I pitched to Greg. He wanted to do it. Like he's used to run Warner Brothers. He's, you know, he makes big movies and he knows how to do that. And so then they went out looking for money. Well, first we cast it, then they went out looking for money and they found it and found distribution. And then we made the movie, or rather they found the money. We made the movie. Then they found distribution after we had something we could sell. So that's like the practical path of how it happened. You know, the confidence part of it is like a very confident person and writer. And that has certainly helped me, but also I'm driven by what I want to do with my craft. And after I made 1%, I wasn't interested in small ideas. I might turn back to them, but I was just at a new point in my life and with my relationship to my craft where I wanted to grow and change. And I wanted to do something bigger. I wanted a bigger challenge, but I also wanted to participate more in what I saw as like the tradition of genre and studio movies, which was like something bigger and slicker. So yeah, in pursuing that new interest, that just led me to making a bigger movie.
From that to casting, I have a very specific question, but hopefully we can get there some meat from it. But I saw that both Desi Lydic and Troy Iwata are in this movie, and I was a big Daily Show fan. Obviously, the cast is stacked. Can you tell us a little bit about casting strategy, working with Stampede, how much control they had, how much control you had, and how you navigated that process?
Sure. Well, we were all just working in sync. I mean, there was nobody that I really liked that they didn't like, or vice versa. And they, on everything, you know, I was a little nervous because I'd never worked with producers who weren't just like my relatives or my friends. And so I thought, maybe, is this the thing that, like, they say it is with Marvel, where somebody tells you exactly what to do and you just have to suck it up, kind of like a puppet? And it wasn't like that at all. Stampede was helpful and additive. They were never telling me what to do. And so the casting process was, you know, we made offers for the bigger roles. So made an offer to Emma, made an offer to Gabby, made an offer to Tom, made an offer to Poppy, and then had an amazing casting director, Jill Thomas, who for the supporting roles was putting people on tape. And then I was choosing people off the tape just based on, do they feel like, am I amused by them? Do they feel right? I really wanted an ensemble that was kind of wacky and specific. I wanted really specific people. And Desi and Troy did not know each other before Space Cadet. It was on Space Cadet that Desi was like, you would be really good on The Daily Show. You should come.
You did that.
I mean, yeah.
It's cool.
I don't know if you can answer this question, but were all your leads the first choices? Like, did you send off those offers as you're like, these are the people we want in the movie and in the roles? And did they all just say yes? Or did you have to go through a bunch of no's before you got to the cast that you have?
There were a few no's on one role that I wound up casting off tape, actually. Oh, wow. And I'm so glad. You know, like, I think when you can, sometimes you just have somebody in your head and you want to make an offer because they're the only person you can think about. But sometimes when you're making an offer, it's because you've seen the actor do the thing before. And I think I did a little of that at first with, you know, one or two of these supporting roles. And then mercifully, when those didn't pan out, then I got to cast somebody where what they were doing was wholly original and I didn't know them and I'd never seen them do that before and nobody had ever seen them do that before.
Just to give some context, Ulrich just, I mean, like a year ago released his first feature. I'm about to make my third feature. So that is why, I mean, I just feel like I probably should contextualize this for you in the beginning. We ask a lot of like really specific questions about career development because we're in the thick of it too. And that you may also notice why we're like centering on leveraging to bigger projects, because obviously every filmmaker is keenly interested in
that. Yeah. Okay, great. Let's talk about leveraging. I mean, I don't know. Are you guys writers too?
Yeah.
Yes.
We both are.
Yeah. I mean, that's the only leverage that I've ever used. It's the only leverage I have, and I've used it, and it's been responsible for my whole directing career. So I really believe in that. Like, I don't know how people do it when they're directors and they don't write.
Yeah.
I think you have like an amazing commercial directing career or something, but I don't know how, if you're not like essentially bribing people with, you want this idea, you got to have me. I don't know how people can hire.
I'm a little curious though about process of directing actors coming from a smaller budget, maybe a more family environment, to working with the Emma Roberts of the world, and that jump as well. I mean, are you able to still have that intimacy of the indie world in a much larger project?
Well, I think that the biggest difference between my experience with actors in my previous movies and with this one was genre, not budget, because, you know, The Lifeguard and 1% More Humid are dramas that have incredibly intimate scenes, whether it's because very dramatic and emotional or because there were a lot of sex scenes in both of those movies. So that does get really intimate, and you're building up a different kind of trust in for movies like that. I didn't change my approach at all with Space Cadet, but, you know, I don't feel like I had to be like a big sister to these actors because, you know, yes, I'm asking for trust, but it wasn't the same kind of trust as it was with the other movies. And, you know, none of these actors, it's not like I was suddenly working with Russell Crowe or someone who's, you know, like legendarily prickly and used to working with a certain kind of director. Like, you know, there wasn't anyone I was working with who I was, let's say, intimidated by. I felt honored to work with all of them, but there were no scary, like, oh, when you talk to Sean Penn, you got to be like this, you got to be like that.
Nobody look him in the eyes, right?
Like that. Yeah. And it is helpful. You know, I talk to everybody, or not everybody, I talk to most of the actors beforehand, and people will tell you the kind of directing they like, which I appreciate. You know, there are people who will say, like, I'm really technical, give me a line reading. You know, there are actors who want that. Then there are people who want it to be more like, who would hate a line reading, or would hate to be told, you're going to look here, then you're going to look here, then you're going to say the line here, then you're going to want, like, everybody's different. So it is helpful when actors can sort of prep you on what works for them. Otherwise, you know, you find it as you go. And that takes a few days.
Liz and I are both parents. New parents of really young babies too. So we're both like trying to figure out how can we make our movies and be parents at the same time. And you talked about doing it with your kids. Can you just give us some words of wisdom or advice of how you're able to juggle making these awesome movies and also being a parent at the same time?
Yes. I hope I can be helpful in this department. I mean, it doesn't look, it gets easier. It only gets easier. I made the lifeguard when my older son was 11 months old. And in a way that wasn't bad because he, and it might've been delusional of me, but I had a feeling like he didn't know if I was gone for 12 hours or 2 hours. So we were shooting in Pittsburgh. His dad was in the movie and produced the movie, and we traveled with our nanny. So it winds up being expensive unless you have someone who is in your family who can be working for 12 hours, 14 hours. Wow. And she, I mean, I should say at this point, like, I've had a substantial TV career. TV has been my bread and butter, and TV has been my benefactor. Like, because I worked in TV, I was able to afford a nanny so that I could get paid next to nothing to direct the lifeguard. Like, there's always got to be somebody. And so I was kind of my own benefactor through my TV career. Because you do need someone. If it's not a partner or a family member, you're paying for childcare, and those hours go up when you're making a movie. But made the lifeguard, it was like relatively easy because, like I said, he wasn't, it was easier than, say, the next movie where I had two kids and they were newly 5 and 2. And they were like, where are you? You know, that was hard. This time they were 10, wait, no, 11 and 8. It's good. And so they, again, you know, I was paying for serious childcare, but I was commuting from home to the set, except for the week when we were in Alabama, and the kids understood what I was doing. And that was huge. Like, it's hard to have to miss things, but I didn't feel like I was hurting them because they knew I was going off to do this thing that I only do once every few years that I love. And then they got to work on the movie one day.
Oh, fun.
And so, I mean, this is all to say, it's all possible. It's a balancing game. What's trickiest is the childcare component, because childcare should be universal, but it's not. And so then you're paying to be able to do your job.
Wow. Big Wonder Falls fan over here. So I had to bring it up. Curious a little bit about marketing while being a multi-hybrid creator. When you're talking to your reps and you're going out for TV jobs, or when you're asking your network about opportunities, are you always referencing your multi-hybrid status? Or are you like, I'm looking for writers gigs right now, or I'm looking, like, are you siloing your efforts, or are you always referencing who you are as an all-encompassing artist?
No, I think I silo because, you know, getting an opportunity, I couldn't be in a financial crisis and be like, get me a directing job ASAP, because I just don't have that type of career. I don't direct TV. It's just not something I've tried very hard to do, though maybe I should. And I don't direct commercials. So it's more like directing movies is what I love, but it takes a few years. So that's not going to pay the bills. So I silo in terms of like, hey, I need a TV writing job, or hey, I need a feature writing job, which also takes longer, is harder to get and takes longer to come together. But I'm, you know, I've had this freelance career since I stopped going on staff of TV shows. Like, I guess I stopped that like 2008 and then resumed maybe 2016. But I'm used to this life where I'm, you know, my yearly salary is like several jobs. So I'm always looking. I'm like, so I think that necessitates siloing. Now, maybe, you know, if I had a different kind of career where I was like such a big auteur that every industry wanted me, perhaps I'd just be like, put my name out there and whatever medium comes calling, great. But it's not like that. So I'm much more targeted about what I need when I need it.
So earlier in the conversation, you talked about wishing you hadn't been as diplomatic in making this movie. And I know you were vague on purpose, but can you give us one example of a time where you felt that and why you ended up making the decision that you made?
Well, okay. So, you know, I can't actually think of a specific example from Space Cadet, but a big moment for me was realizing on one of my first movies, the producer and the AD and the DP were arguing in front of me. And I started to mediate the argument, to play diplomat, to come up with a solution. And it had something to do with the schedule and the this and the that. I don't remember specifically, but I know that my instinct kicked in to help the boys stop fighting. And when that was over and we'd concluded whatever we'd concluded, and it's not that that was of massive consequence, but I realized kind of walking away from it that I was not doing my job in helping them mediate. Their job is to not do that shit in front of me, to not do that shit at all. And what I was doing was trying to find a solution to their argument as opposed to an actual solution to the problem that would solve it and give me what I wanted for the movie. But I was so trained in my life to like bring the temperature down that that was what I did rather than say, like, go solve this problem by yourself, or here's what's going to happen. And it has nothing to do with what you want or you want or you want. It's what the movie wants or what I want. Mm.
Along those lines, I've come up against this issue in terms of coverage versus specialty shots when you're up against the clock. And I'd just be curious what your take is. A DP once said to me that when you have very little time left, you should prioritize the thing that you bring to the table, right? Like the interesting twist that you bring to the table instead of the traditional coverage, because anyone could do the traditional coverage.
Yeah. Love that.
I know. It really kind of like impacted me when I heard that. When you are up against the clock, how do you triage that moment as a director?
Well, I mean, my heavy sighing is because it's so tricky, because sometimes the thing to do is to not triage. Like sometimes if, say, it's not the sun setting, it's about some other schedule factor and it's a little, people are creating urgency, but it's not nature creating urgency. And, you know, sometimes you have to be like, no, we're getting it all and then we'll deal with it. But in a case where you can't, you know, I think I tend to go with the coverage so I know I'm telling the story and just that I got it.
Yeah.
Like I probably do that. And, you know, and then knowing that there are other scenes where I'll have more time or other scenes where I'll be able to get everything I want and more. But this also all goes to prep, and maybe it's not coverage and a specialty shot. Maybe it's actually should be that even your coverage is your specialty shot. Like you feel so solid about coverage, or your specialty shot is your coverage, if you know what I mean. It's like, yeah. I aspire to Spielberg level camera movement matches blocking. That is for me the most difficult level of achievement in cinema, is that kind of perfectly seamless relationship between the camera and the storytelling, the camera movement and the storytelling. And the camera, I was just watching Jack Reacher for the first time. I love it. And realized that I owed it to Tom Cruise really to watch this movie. And I was so struck by how that camera in that movie just completely controlled the flow of information. And it wasn't through cutting. It wasn't like, we're cutting over here so you can see this person's reaction. We're cutting over here. It was, the camera is going to show you this clue. Then it's going to dolly and show you this face. Then it's going to pan and show you this. And it was all so meticulously crafted. And it's such confident filmmaking because it's planned in advance, knowing that the camera that you're not going to cut. So you know what the pace is going to be and you know what the audience has to know in each micro moment. That's what I aspire to.
Yeah. It's a thing of beauty.
Yeah.
When you see it done well and then you're watching something where it's done not well, it's like so striking. Like, yeah. What are you doing? Come on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But man. It's I think it does require such confidence as the director to not be creating your shots out of a sense of frantic urgency.
Yeah.
Scarcity mindset, right?
The mindset. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I think we have just about 5 minutes left. So we should get to our final five questions. So these are just rapid fire stuff. So we'll try to go as fast as we can. What's the first film you made and how do you feel about it now? It could be a short film, could be a student project, could be your first feature, whatever, however you want to answer it.
So the first film I made was in my sight and sound class at Wesleyan. It was a black and white, silent, probably like 2 minute film about two neighbors who spot each other, my friend Carla and her boyfriend, spotting each other in their respective backyards and sort of doing little courtship dances for each other. And I feel great about it because I feel like it really sums up kind of my soul. Like it's about love and connection, but it's absurd and making fun of itself. Well, also I hope being kind of stylish, but not too cool for school. Like it just was so pure because all I was thinking about is like, what would amuse me? And there you have it.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received or heard?
Oh my God.
It's tough to be rapid fire. Sorry to put the pressure on that.
Okay. No. Oh, okay. When you're directing actors, give them verbs, not adjectives. You're telling them what to do.
Nice. What's the worst filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Okay, that's good. I don't know that I've received like terrible filmmaking. Oh, maybe like treat actors like drug addicts or children. That's the full quote.
Wow.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
Yeah. My goal is to bridge the gap between the director I am and the director that I think I can be. In my head, it's like that Ira Glass thing where he talks about that's what you do over the course of your career is you're just bridging the gap between kind of like your vision and your skill level.
If you could go back in time, what's the one piece of advice you would give yourself?
To bet on myself much earlier in my career, and meaning in terms of instead of chasing like other people's paychecks based on other people's rewriting jobs or open writing assignments, writing my own specs and being my own, like fully being my own benefactor much earlier, as opposed to chasing jobs that were kind of about the affirmation of someone hiring me. Because those didn't turn out well.
Our last question is making movies hard?
It is really hard. However, it's so fun that actually my experience is that the net result is so much easier than people think. And maybe I shouldn't talk about that so much because it's nice to be respected and have people think what you do is really hard, but it's just so, so, so enjoyable that I can't believe it's a job.
We have a couple of minutes. I want to sneak one more question in. Now that you've jumped to this level of making this mid-tier movie, have you noticed any changes in the opportunities that you have before you? Or is it kind of too early to tell like what this is going to result in for your career?
I would say A, it's too early to tell. And B, I don't assume that anything will happen. I'm just going to keep going the way that I go, which is writing what I want to make. It doesn't really matter if people come to me with opportunities because I don't want to make other people's work. So it's just going to be me continuing to write what interests me.
Amazing. Liz, what do you remember about our talk with the other Liz?
That I just found myself trying to impress her, that I was like, just tried to say things that I thought were smart or that like could be really good questions, or like, I just really like found myself looking up to her and just having this like career crush on her. You know what I mean? Like, she's just cool and honest and decent, and I like her, and I wanted to like, I don't know, to have a good interview, I guess.
I just want this to go well, okay?
Yes, I just want this to be good. Well. It's like so wrong. It's so bad because it's like we're supposed to, I'm not saying we're journalists, we're not journalists, but I think we're supposed to be like somewhat objective because then we can ask questions that are a little bit more biting, a little bit more intrusive from time to time, right? Not play it so safe. But I just found myself, like, I think you could hear me in the interview just be like, you're so cool. Like, I literally just lost it a little bit because I was just very, like, impressed by her. What do you remember?
A little of the Chris Farley energy coming out there.
That was awesome.
Oh, such an idiot.
Oh. I love Chris Farley.
Oh, man. Yeah, no. I remember at one moment being like, why am I wearing this terrible shirt? And she looked so cool in her outfit that she had for her press day. And I'm like, I look like a bum. I'm a bum interviewing this impressive person.
Yeah. No,
but you know, I thought she was great. I really loved, you know, just how open she was about her career and her whole mentality, and I thought it was really interesting. You know, she obviously puts a lot of pressure on herself because, like, she was like referencing, like, oh, you know, I should be making $100 million movies like some of the people that I've worked right. with. You know, that when I made my movie and it premiered at Sundance, like some of those people in that same class went on to make, you know, big budget, you know, movies. And I looked up who they were, and it was like Ryan Coogler, and I'm like, oh my god, you're comparing yourself to Ryan Coogler? Like, that's the life that you live? It's like, man. I mean, what great motivation, you know, but like also like an unfortunate person to compare yourself to because they're a complete outlier and, you know, like there's only one Coogler, right? Like, you know, so.
Well, I think her argument is that like she's just as good, right? And so, yeah. And it's that conviction is beautiful and I don't deny it, but I know what you're saying. It's like he's an outlier, but does it have to do entirely with talent? I don't know. Is it timing? Is it relationships? There's a lot of things that go on.
It's everything, right? You know, yeah. And I mean, like, she's no slouch, though.
Yeah.
I guess my point is, like, she's a very successful filmmaker and an artist, you know, and like, I think it's just interesting that you see, like, that's how greatness is. One of the ways that it's spurred and given flame and fire is like by those kinds of situations and those kinds of comparisons, I guess, to some way. I'm not saying that we should compare ourselves to people who are outliers who we can't live up to, but I mean, I'm just thinking that like that's definitely probably where part of her fire and passion and her determination and her ability to make these things happen comes from, is because she's putting herself at that level, which she rightly should, you know?
Yeah.
Because she did do the same. She did have her first feature premiere at Sundance, just like Ryan Coogler did. She did have like a movie star in her movie, just like Ryan Coogler did, you know, who went on to become, you know, a big time movie star. It's like the same, yeah. Like if you look at it, it's like the same like pieces, but like, you know, she ended up in one area and he ended up in another area, and it's like, yeah, is it just sex? Like, that's probably definitely part of it for sure. Like, we're not going to deny that, you know, but like there's probably like 1,000 other variables in play that you can't really, you know, define so easily. It's not like, yeah. If she was a man who made that exact same movie and Ryan Coogler was a woman, like, would it go the opposite way? Maybe, but maybe not. You know, like, who's to say? We will never know unless someone makes that alternate dimension where we can find out. But
that's your next movie. That's your third movie.
Exactly. Right. But yeah, what did everyone think about this? I would love to hear people's reaction to this interview because I just thought it was fantastic. And yeah, I can't wait to see Space Cadet. It sounds like it's going to be a really fun movie. And yeah, I think like Liz is going to be somebody that we're seeing more and more of in the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 plus whatever years, you know. But without any further delay, it is time for the game. What is the game, you ask? Well, it is a game that our producer Eric Toms invented where we are challenged with a filmmaking scenario, a filmmaking quandary that we are stuck in as an independent filmmaker, and we have to figure out a solution to it. Liz has never heard this before. I'm going to ask Liz the question today. She has never heard it. She doesn't know what it's going to be about. I actually even haven't read it. I like reading them blind because I think it's more fun because I get to react to it as I read it. But here we go. This is today's The Game question. You are 2 weeks into your latest horror action feature. Horror action. Oh my God. It has been problem after problem. Actors have gotten hurt and had to be replaced. Producers have promised more than they can deliver. And producers' cost is skyrocketing. Huh. Producers' tune cost.
Production costs?
Oh, yeah. That's probably what it is. And production's cost is skyrocketing. Your line producer comes to you and breaks the news. You won't be able to complete the film with your remaining budget. Okay. Tough. Mm. Even if you cut major scenes and triple up your roles on the film, you just won't be able to finish the film. You're going to need more money. So he's basically saying, with the current budget you have, there's no way to use the resources you have to make to finish this thing. Do you, A, start a crowdfunding campaign while you're in production with the hope you'll raise enough money while still shooting? Halt production and try to raise the money, then start up again, risking that locations, actors, and crew may not be available when you're ready to go. Reach out to rich people that may... Reach out to rich people. I love it. Just those rich people out there, just reach out to them. They love that. Rich people love it when people reach out to them to ask for money that may be interested rather than getting donations. But those people may want a cut of revenues, which would disrupt your original investors. D other. What do you do, director? What do you do?
Do you know that people sometimes email me their responses to the game questions? Like, they're like, you should have done this. You should have done that.
I never get those. I love that. You should share those on the show. That'd be amazing.
I might. But what's coming to mind is, so Cameron Burns, who is a future guest of the show, he weighed in on a game question to me once. And it was the one where you said, I think you read it. And it was like, the director of an indie movie is like emotionally or psychologically falling apart. And it's like, they're your friend, but what do you do? Do you step in and direct the movie for them? There's a point to me referencing this, I promise. The point is that like all of these movies have producers and stakeholders that are expecting deliverables. And if I find out that we ran out of money, it begs the question, where does the original money come from? And if it comes from investors, then I still have to think about if they're going to allow me to bring in more investors or not, right? Because they sign investor agreements where they have a certain percentage for the money that they put in, and everything kind of falls apart if you bring in more partners. So I don't think I could bring in rich people. Not that I know any rich people, but I don't think I could just go and find new investors. And it sounds like I'm the director of this project, right? Ulrich, am I the director?
Yeah, you're the director, yeah.
So this really feels like a producer's question. Like the producer should have foreseen this problem and safeguarded against it with contingencies. So this scenario most likely would never happen. But if you have a bad producer and I'm put in a position of making a decision, I think I'd halt production, because to me, this is a red flag of a bad producer. And I don't know if I would really want to go forward with a producing team who would allow this to happen in the first place. It makes me feel like my actors aren't being protected. They're not in safe conditions, and that we would have to reevaluate a lot of things in order to keep going. Keep on going through hell doesn't seem to be the right option here. But I'm hearing Cameron Burns in my head saying, like, I still owe the investors something. So I feel like I would talk to the investors, talk to my producers, and air my concerns about safety and how the money has been spent thus far, possibly bring on a whole new producing team that I trust and get the investors buy-in to bring in more money. So I would make an effort to move forward knowing that I might have to halt production. So that is where I am. Ulrich, where are you?
Well, I'd definitely go to the investors first with the lead producer and be like, here's the situation that we're in. You know, we are X dollars short from finishing the movie because of this reason. And just see what they have to say, because maybe like the original investors are probably the first people who may or may not be able to help, you know, bridge the gap, you know?
Yeah.
So I would probably do that. And then I would figure out exactly how much more money we would need and why. So I can like have that conversation clearly, you know, because you don't want to just ask for more money. Like, we need more money. It's like you need to have like, I think people don't really understand like that when you're making a movie like this, like, you are responsible for the money that you have been, you know, that has been invested into your project. Like, as the producer or the director or both. I mean, I guess I've always been like the producer, one of the producers and the director. So like, I've always shared that responsibility. And so I think if you're not the producer and you're just the director, it's not, like you said, it's not really on you. Like, that's not your responsibility to figure out like the money and be responsible for the money or whatever. Although I do think that as you're making decisions as a director, you should be keeping that in your mind, because you don't want to be irresponsible, you know, and you don't want to like set yourself up to go over budget. Like, you want to be play within the you know, the rules and the sphere you've been given, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I would definitely, like, I'm assuming I'm a producer as well as a director, that this is my project, that I'm not just a hired gun. So if that's the case, then yeah, I would gather the investors and the producer, and we would like figure out what we need. And then if we couldn't raise it, then yeah, I think we would halt production until we could raise it. You know, if it's impossible to make the movie with the resources you have, there's no point trying, right? Like, if he didn't add that line in about like, you can't, you know, tripling up roles or whatever, blah, 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 like, you're not going to be able to do it.
We're far away. Yeah.
Yeah. I would figure out a way, like, you know, like, I would minimize crew. I would cut this expensive location, like, whatever. I would do whatever I can to save money to like make it work, you know. But given that he said that's not an option, then yeah, go to your original investors, see what they think, you know. And like, let's say they say, okay, well, we're not going to put any more money, but like, we're okay if you seek additional investment. Then I would seek additional investment, and I would give myself a timeline, you know, of like, I have this many days to figure this out, you know, before we halt production, you know. And I would make sure everyone knew what was going on and that we were all on the same page. I think that's how I would handle it, because it's not worth it. Like, if you're just going to fail, like, don't just do it anyways, you know. Yeah. Like, you definitely need to stop. And, you know, if your investors aren't willing or able to help you solve this problem, and if they said, hey, no, we're not open to seeking additional investment on this, which I think would be mad. Like, there's no way that they would say that, because like, then you'd basically like, look, well, we made half a movie that you can't make your money back on, you know. Yeah, assuming they would probably say either be able to cut, like, help you find the rest of the money, or be okay if you found it from other sources. So I would probably do that. And then like, if I couldn't get it done in time, then I would just take as long as I need to get the movie together, get the money together. And then I would edit what I have together into a movie. Mm-hmm. And then see how I can finish this movie with whatever resources I can raise and make it work, you know? And yeah, if that's changing the script, changing the scenes, cutting things down, whatever is needed to get a complete story with a beginning, middle, and end that works.
Wow.
Great question.
Yeah. Does anyone out there want to email the podcast email address to let us know how they would answer this differently? So send an email to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to Liz W. Garcia for coming on the show. Thanks to Danella Lalas from Katrina Juan PR for setting this up. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Rymood, for doing the editing. Robert Jones for handling all of our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for just being awesome. Thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to you all next week.
My kids are 13, and now, and I'm like, shut up, mommy's working.
That sounds amazing.
Oh, yes, man.
It'll happen. I know it seems like a long way away, but it will happen. Yeah.